Before we get into this week's podcast, I would like to read to you one action item that you could add to your health routine this week. This is from Tommy's quite brilliant highlights email series. I will put the link for you to sign up in the show notes if you would like to see this in writing with all of the references. The action item is be the first person to say hello. How simple and beautiful is that? There are only two things that predict happiness, money and social connectedness. However, there is a cutoff beyond which more money won't make you happier, and luckily, social connection is free. While we should all put in the work to be part of a great family and group of friends, social connection should also happen quickly and spontaneously whenever you meet another person. Though these interactions may be brief, they are biologically very important. The real problem is that once loneliness sets in, it becomes reinforced in a self-perpetuating cycle. This is because lonely people become hypervigilant and react more quickly to negative social stimuli and social threat. In other words, when you're lonely, you react by becoming more attuned to negativity from others as a self-protective mechanism to avoid danger, which causes you to withdraw even further. Importantly, even small acts of social acceptance can reverse these negative behaviors. So, instead of listening to the latest podcast next time you're out in public, break with the modern social convention and say hello to your fellow humans. You never know who might benefit. Now, over to the podcast. Hello, and welcome to the Nourish, Balance, Thrive podcast. My name's Christopher Kelly, and today I'm joined by Christian Manietta. Hi, Christian.
Hey, Chris, how you doing?
I am great this morning. Thank you for asking. For everyone listening, Christian is a husband, he is a dad, he is a coach, he has celiac disease, which I know he's managing extremely well. He's a life athlete, he's an entrepreneur, and he is the host at the Fat Black podcast on trispecific.com. I will, of course, link to those things in the show notes. Christian, thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me, Chris. And I must say, because people have been going, the Fat Black podcast, what the hell? Are you racist or something?
Oh, yeah, it does need clarification, I suppose.
It usually does. It's usually just simply because, you know, I add butter to coffee and have been doing for many, many years and prior to it becoming in vogue.
Isn't that funny? You know, that thought had never even crossed my mind. And that worries me a little bit. You know, am I autistic in some way that I only see things in black and white? That's kind of scary. Okay, well, thank you for that clarification. Christian, I wanted to start this interview by asking you about your life as a professional snowboarder. How did you get into that?
Well, it was an interesting one. I always skateboarded as a kid and a little bit of surfing, and was always very athletic and played a sport in Australia called rugby league. And that was my thing. Like, I had grandeur dreams that everything was focused on that. You know, I played some representative football and, you know, I wanted to become professional in that. And I was getting, you know, teenage years, and there was a few things that happened politically, you know, when coaches don't like your parents or your dad or, you know. So I got dropped from a couple of teams, and there was a whole bunch of politics involved in that after playing really well. And I was like, screw this team stuff. And at that time, around about that time, my brother and I had watched a Quicksilver video, I think it was, and there was some snowboarding in it. I was like, oh, yeah. Wow, that looks pretty good.
Yeah.
I think I just got my license, and I was like, you know what? I've never been to the snow. So we pretty much drove down to the snow in Australia, and it was about, you know, 6 hour drive from Sydney, and that was it. I was hooked, and I thought, you know, this is fun. And then I think I somehow over that next year, I kept going back to this snowboard shop in Sydney and called Balmoral Boards, and he was running a trip to Whistler, funnily enough. So I thought, hell, I'm going to get onto that trip. It was a 2 week trip to Whistler. I think I was, you know, 17 at the time.
Oh, wow. That's amazing.
And I was the youngest, I think, 17 or something, and or maybe I was just 18. I can't remember. It was one of the two. But, you know, it was I think the next youngest person on that trip was like 35. So, you know, I had to do a few things. Like, back then it was the good old go-kart driving license, and it's a 19 drinking age in Canada, in BC. So, you know, I had to do the go into the snowboard shop when I was over there and cut out some numbers and swap them around so I could get into the bars.
Do you know what? I think I've done that. I can remember doing that when I was 17 in the UK, actually, and doing it for other people as well, actually. Now I've come to think of it.
So, yeah, that kind of was the start. And then I just fell hook, line and sinker for it, and was like, I love this. I don't want to miss another season of this. And it kind of progressed from there. And then I watched a competition once in Australia. I'm like, you know what? I think I can be as good as these guys. And that set that trajectory.
And what did you see? What type of snowboarding was it that you were doing?
More of the big air stuff. I was, you know, kind of liked sending it. So, you know, all the trick kind of stuff. Didn't play too much in a half pipe, but more of the big jumps and, you know, slopestyle was kind of the end of my snowboard career was coming in. But prior to that, you know, we'd have big air competition. So it was a one jump stuff and just, you know, playing around resorts with friends and then eventually into the backcountry.
Oh, wow. That's amazing. And you earned enough money to call it a living then?
It wasn't a ton, but I did get paid from some sponsors and there were, you know, we got a little bit of money. And at that time in life and at that young, you didn't need that much money. You know, you kind of live in the dream, right? So, you know, lots of people crammed into houses and, you know, I got on a bunch of trips that got paid for. You know, it all started because I kind of forced my way, or didn't really force my way onto a trip. I got myself onto a trip. A bunch of friends were leaving Whistler and they were going on a trip for a snowboard magazine and it, you know, it's a 32-hour drive from Whistler to Colorado. And they're like, just come, you know, the editor will be fine. It's all good. So, you know, I jump in, there's eight of us in a van and piled high with snowboards and everything and got down there. He's like, the editor's like, well, I can't really send you back, can I? So I got a couch and I made my worth known that very first day when no one wanted to ride and I went up in horrible conditions and did a couple of tricks and he was like, oh my God, I can't believe I didn't have the photographer here. And he said, if you do that again, you'll get a poster in the magazine, but that ended up being a 4-page interview. So I did pretty well out of it. And he really was a guy that helped me get some of my first sponsors.
That's amazing. And now you live not in Whistler, but in British Columbia, right?
We were in Whistler. We moved just down the road into the outdoor adventure capital of British Columbia in Squamish. And we're actually moving back up to Whistler because our son goes to school there. It's really funny. Full circle. Finished snowboarding in 2002. Even though he'd been back to Canada a couple of times as an endurance athlete, you know, it's funny that nearly 3 years ago now we decided to come on a year adventure and this is where we're calling home now.
Awesome. That's amazing. Yes, I know Squamish. I've ridden a mountain bike there several times and it's a fantastic place to ride a bike if anyone listening ever gets the chance. It's really pretty cool. And then Whistler is obviously awesome as well.
Whistler's awesome. The street I live in Squamish at the moment is called Perth Drive. And just a continuous stream of mountain bikers riding up the street because the trailhead's just at the top of our street. So it's quite good. And then all the ones off the university. So it's pretty sweet.
Excellent. Well, the main reason I wanted to have you on today was to talk about your role as a triathlete coach, which is what now takes up all of your time. Am I correct in thinking that?
Yes.
And I thought a really good place to start would be to ask you how on earth you managed to go from an Ironman time of over 11 hours, 11 hours, 27 to under 9 hours, which I think very few people on the planet will ever achieve. Like, am I right with those numbers before we go any further?
Yeah. So 11:27, I think was my first Ironman and 8:57 is my fastest.
Okay. So what the heck? Tell me about the first one. What were you doing to get the time of 11:27? I can't believe that, you know, so it's not just talent, right? Like you could argue that some people are just genetically gifted and you could get them to do jumping jacks and they would get a great time no matter what they did, right? Well, this is obviously not the case here. So what were you doing in the lead up to your first Ironman?
Oh, probably everything wrong. I was 25 and coming off a, you know, professional snowboard career, I had a pretty, let's say, healthy, unhealthy ego as a 25-year-old. And, you know, I knew about the Hawaiian Ironman and being that you want to go from zero to hero really quick in terms of your capabilities. And the reality was I just hadn't done the aerobic training. Yeah, I'd been hiking in the mountains, snowboarding, and, you know, you develop a lot of aerobic fitness, which you don't realize in the backcountry or hiking for hitting kickers and stuff. But it was completely different to swim, bike, and run. And my wife and I fell hooked again, same with snowboarding. We just fell into this sport. And unfortunately or fortunately, the group we fell into was all geared towards Ironman. We're thinking we're going to turn up and do some sprint races. So we started training around, I think it was about August 2002. And that December, we did our first half Ironman, or 70.3 as they're called now. And that following, I think it was the first weekend of April, was our first Ironman.
Was it more fun than snowboarding? I just can't, I don't know. I just
know it was really funny going from super baggy clothes to Lycra.
It is quite a harsh transition, I would say.
It was, but you know what? I've always, like, I like to consider myself a life athlete. And, you know, I did, obviously playing rugby league, I did a lot of running and we did a lot of conditioning work. And through snowboarding, so that, you know, from when I started snowboarding at 16 odd, all that conditioning stuff just went out the window. It was all about, you know, drinking beers, eating crappy food and snowboarding. So that kind of disappeared. And then it was just like, you know, there wasn't like this which they are. They're so polar opposites. But it just kind of, my wife wanted to do a marathon and we kind of fell into triathlon. And then, you know, you get into a community and a group and it was like, this is fun. And look at the toys. You get to ride bikes fast.
Yeah.
You know, all this stuff. So we kind of went that path and we had an Ironman coach and I just did what most guys do and just revved it too hard each and every session and let ego get in the way and want to progress too quickly. I just was trying to rush performance and ultimately I got injured about 6 weeks out from the first Ironman. I had ITB really bad and I spent thousands of dollars trying to see everyone under the sun to try and fix that. So I went into that race with an injury where I really couldn't run more than 2K and I did meet someone, a chiropractor and ART therapist who's still a very good friend to this day, who's been integral to what I know about the body now. He treated me and didn't touch ITB and basically he got me to be able to run 27 kilometers fatigued off the swim and the bike before I had the same pain. So there's a little bit of walking and stuff like that in that back end of the marathon. But the injury aside, I think I would have had the same result anyway. I would have most likely went out and gone out too hard and blown myself up.
Right.
My wife went and hit it out of the park. She was getting absolutely smashed in every training session by everyone else. And then she goes and does a, you know, I think it was a 10:29 or something and qualifies for the Hawaiian Ironman, comes second in her age group and, you know, was just like, wow, you've just beaten all the girls that kicked your ass and most of the guys. I think she was only like three people in the whole group that beat her. So it was like, oh, you're okay at this. And that kind of set a trajectory. We went to Hawaii that year and I watched that and the seed was kind of developed, but it took time. It took, that was 2003 and what was it 2007 was when I broke 9 hours. So 4 to 5 years of consistent up and downs and changing the type of training that we did. And I just like asking questions and I got to a point going, you know what? I'm not sure this is the right way. And then trying different pathways and same with nutrition was always in that, like, always asking questions. Why are we doing it this way? Is there a better way to do it? Okay. And over that time kind of got to a point where I don't think I'm the most talented athlete at all. Kind of spatial awareness. I think I have some type of a gift there, but the reality is I just put in the hard work and I expanded the time of that hard work and showed up. Properly showed up when I showed up and over time it works.
Right,
and
right.
While at first I tried to rush, you know, when I just kept being consistent over the long haul, as the saying goes, you know, hard work trumps talent when talent doesn't work.
I like that. So let's break this down then, your approach to the training before. So were you just literally going out and smashing it every time you went out or were you doing more kind of gray zone training, you know, that kind of 150 to 170 beats, maybe not full out race pace, but definitely getting there, can't hold a conversation or breathe through your nose type pace or what was it?
Yeah, it was more gray zone. It's more the zone that everyone trains in because they don't see the benefit of what easy does for them and what actual true easy is and when they're not bullshitting themselves.
Right.
So yeah, it was just tons and tons of gray zone training. So, you know, you're training too hard when it's meant to be easy and you can't then train hard enough when you're meant to go for it. So,
yeah. Do you know what? I paid a coach a couple of years ago, Chris McGovern, who said that to me once. It's true that if you don't go easy on the easy days, then you won't be able to go hard on the hard days, right? It's really important.
It is.
So how did the training evolve? Like, did you immediately, I don't want to say the name Maffetone because I don't know, maybe that's too much of a loaded question, but he seems very influential amongst many endurance athletes. So is that the type of approach that you took?
No.
Okay. Good answer.
I've had many, many conversations with the, as I call him, the good doctor now. We've had him on our podcast a number of times and had him on when I did the Triathlon World Summit and a whole bunch of off-air conversations with him. And I absolutely love what he does and math works. There's no doubt about it. I don't think it's the be-all and end-all. I don't think you have to do it. I think math needs to be mixed in your training mix without a doubt. Mm. So there's parts where I will differ. What I started to see was a lot of athletes breaking down all the time and I started searching in and out of the sport and I figured, started to think that the reality is Ironman is a long day, but it's not necessarily just an endurance sport. It's really comes down to strength and it's the ability to hold form under duress. And I found some people and we got a different viewpoint where we kind of flipped the good old training pyramid up on its head. So completely flipped it upside down. And early on in the phase was working strength and little bits of speed to hold on to that natural stuff. Because what we saw as an athlete now, it kind of depends on where you're coming in, because the Maffetone method will work, but you've got to drop the ego and you've got to go really slow to develop those aerobic pathways. We kind of played around with it. A separate way of doing it where we tried to maintain the athlete's natural speed and develop on their strengths. Now, to say that, we weren't doing like HIIT training and or smashing it all the time, because if you look at the bookends of each session, there's a lot of easy, which you could then consider, hey, this is the Maffetone part of the session, and then we get to work. And we may develop, we're trying to develop these, recruit more, you know, strength fibers to be able to, you know, contract forcibly for a long period of time.
Right.
And then we started looking at the systems of the body and going, okay, well, we can go like most working corporate or time poor people that get the chunk of their aerobic work done on the weekend. We could then still train Monday and Tuesday and maybe have some short speed stuff in the pool, which kind of creates a little bit of an anabolic response, and then do a pretty hard trainer set on a Tuesday, which makes a massive anabolic muscular response. So the session's hard muscularly, but because the reps are so short, it's not really having an aerobic impact. So, because what I'd seen over time was that we'd smash out these weekend sessions, have a Monday off, and then Tuesday you're going and hitting time trials or hard stuff in a group environment on the bike. And over time, like at first you get away with it, but over time you're just smashing the aerobic system and that high-end aerobic system.
Yeah.
And we all know that you can, the muscular system recovers fairly quickly, depending on how much damage you do, but you know, anywhere from 24 to 72 hours, right? You really finish. But if you really whack your aerobic system, that could take, you know, weeks or months to really recover from.
Yeah, totally. Everybody knows someone that's ended their season early by just burning out before it's really gotten going.
Yeah, so you see the supercompensation curve go the wrong way, because at first it's you have this big hit on the weekend, you take a recovery, and then you're fairly recovered, and then you just go and smash it again, and then you keep doing that the rest of the week, and then over it just starts trending down relatively quickly. And what we learn is going, well, maybe if we have, especially, this is going pretty deep here when we start looking at body types of athletes, but if you have like myself, more of a mesomorph, I can recruit a lot of muscle fiber quickly and really do a number on myself. And the thing is, if I kept doing that, then I'm going to burn out or I'm going to get injured. And what we found is if I can put a little bit of usable fatigue on the body, or call it an insurance policy, then I could go and push hard, but because I have a little bit of what I'd consider good fatigue, not bad fatigue, then I've kind of put a governor on how hard or how deeply I can recruit or how hard I can go in that session. And therefore, I recover much quicker and I can get onto some good training. But it's definitely an undulating mix of training, and there's a lot of bookend of easy on either side, which then that's where I consider. And I am anal on it with my athletes these days and pull them up all the time. Like, easy is easy. You can't bullshit yourself. Right. Yeah. Try breathing through your nose. That's a way to do it. Or can you hold a conversation? I do know a few athletes that can hold a conversation while going hard.
Yeah, I can do that. I can hold a conversation at 170 BPM quite easily.
So, you know, typically the nose breathing, it works pretty well. But honestly, I think it's just being honest with yourself. And I love coaching more on intuitive pacing guidelines versus giving hard and fast heart rate numbers or power numbers. Primarily because, as you know too well, that there's so many factors every day that impact our heart rate, whether it's nutrition, whether it's environmental factors, whether you just had a fight with your spouse,
right,
got angry with your kids, or you've lost your job or something like that. There's going to be impacts of heart rate.
Right, right.
So, you know, that you're, hey, I need to sit in 150 to 160 today, that could be completely skewed. You know, you could actually be at that same physiological part of 150 to 160, but you might be at 120 and 130, or you could be at 170 and 180.
Right, I understand.
And just because of all of those impacts. But when I get people to go, you know what, just chill, understand these intuitive intensity guidelines, and stuff will fall into the mix. Because if something breaks on race day, if your Garmin doesn't work or your heart rate monitor doesn't work, you can still actually perform.
Yeah.
And I think in this age of gimmickry, there is so much noise and people don't know themselves.
Right.
And so they're completely lost.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, having to look at their watch every 5 seconds to see what pace they're running. It's like, geez. And case in point, the first time I broke 9 hours and my wife actually won the race in the female field outright and I beat her by just over 2 minutes. I still hold the house record, definitely.
Just.
It was the first time I beat her. On the bike, we had a good old cat eye. And it was really Fandangle back then. It had, I think it had wireless speed and cadence. So okay, we're ahead nice. Of the curve there. So all we had showing was cadence. And on the run, we had a good old Timex 100 lap stopwatch. So, you know, if we wanted to pace, we'd hope that they put the kilometer markings in the right spot and would kind of get an idea. But that's how we paced. And right. just totally intuitive. This is what I feel like I can stay in moderate or moderate hard, which is comfortably uncomfortable. And that's kind of where I stayed. And, you know, there's going to be ebbs and flows when it's harder and other points like that. And, you know, I have some pretty in-depth qualifications what each of those are. And I just find you become a healthier athlete for it.
Okay. Talk about like the peak of the training. So like maximal volume, maybe a month or so ahead of a big event. What would that look like? I'm just wondering what the blend of training looks like, you know, maybe endurance, run, bike, swim versus strength training versus something else maybe. Can you do that?
Yeah, for sure. When I started speaking before how we flipped the pyramid essentially on its head, what we're thinking is if we have developed this speed and strength early on, when it comes time to do the right. longer race-specific stuff, we're stronger and faster already. So we're able to tolerate the demands placed upon us when we need to put okay. volume. You know, it's $1 million question, how much volume?
Right.
It really depends on athletic age and how long they've been in the sport and how long they've got.
Right.
But I'm definitely not a fan of some athletes may hit 20 hours, some okay. in that last push to their main race. But typically, you know, we'd see a lot of people, if I had to put an average, it'd be in that last number of weeks, say six, you know, depending on how long they've been, the more consistency, the shorter this period can be. But 6 to 8 weeks, they may sit between 15 and build up to 18 hours a week
okay.
of swim, bike, run. And with a little bit of strength stuff, I do put a lot of strength stuff within the sessions. So with the right tools in swimming, we can use paddles and bands so we can effectively strengthen the right pathways we need for those sports. In the bike, obviously there's big gear stuff. And on the run, we can use hills and we can also play around with, I'm doing ultra running at the moment and I've actually employed a very successful ultra coach and he's got us doing some lunge matrices prior to a run, just building leg resiliency and it's great. And we finish off with some core and extra leg work and it's really time efficient. So some of the stuff that I'm playing with, but yeah, typically what it really depends on is the athlete's life circumstance, because I can write the best plan in the world, but if it doesn't fit their life circumstance, right. well, then it's the worst plan in the world, isn't yeah. it? Because they can't do it. So some people cannot do a double session day. They right. just can't because of work and family. So we have to blend the training mix to make sure that we get what's needed done. I'm not a fan of going, hey, we're going to build up your weaknesses to make them a strength. That typically doesn't happen. So what we want to do is have a look at their weaknesses and not make them a liability on race day.
Okay.
And then really work their strengths because it's going to help them in the race. Uh-huh. So, you know, a lot of people in our sport, their weakness is swimming.
Okay.
So it's getting them to understand the true cost of swimming in a triathlon and especially in an Ironman is that, yes, it might be the shortest part of the day, but it's one of the most important. And there's no shortcuts of doing the work in the pool. So you don't get out of the water like a fish out of water. So the swim, that hour to 2 hours or sub hour to 2 hours for some people, doesn't take it out of you, because I've seen so many people going, hey, they're phenomenal bikers and great runners. They'd never get anywhere near their potential because they're so destroyed from the swim because they underestimate the cost.
I'm just laughing because it's just so hard for me to get my head around it. You know, I do some pretty crazy stuff on, not crazy, but the ordinary people on the street would think is crazy on the mountain bike. But then when I look at the start of a triathlon, I'm like, holy shit, you would never get me to do that. That is terrifying.
It is, but they're slowly changing it. There's not too many races these days that have that beautiful mass start, that washing machine, but that creates a whole lot of anxiety. And again, when you have a lot of people that underestimate that cost and aren't doing the swim training, we unfortunately have seen a bunch of deaths in swims. You know, anxiety is a great way that if anyone right. has an underlying heart problem, they don't know.
Yeah, serious
heart attacks in the swim. So they put a big Swim Smart program in place, and I still think people need to really respect the swim and the distance and the work it takes. But they're doing more rolling starts now, and where they just right. it's yeah, just a continuous. That. Continuous rolling start, which I was against, but when I raced Ironman Canada last year, I think I was fourth into the water. It was fantastic. It was actually really nice.
Yeah, I think you should think about that in cyclocross. That'd be so much nicer if the start of a cyclocross race, that everybody could just like soft pedal off the line really, really sensibly. There'd be less accidents. It'd be much more fun, I think.
Come on, everyone wants to kill each other.
So oh my God, it's nuts, yeah. Especially if you've got a bunch of 16-year-olds in the race. That's my favorite. So my takeaway from this then, that so not the marathon approach, which is interesting because that's the first person I've heard say that for some time, but just to connect the dots a little bit, I interviewed Mike T. Nelson, who's exercise physiologist, and that was one of his main concerns as well, was the strength to hold good form throughout the duration of your event, right? You don't really want to be all like saggy and floppy like a rag doll as you finish one stage of the race and then you move on to the next. That's not, but you're not using strength training to achieve that form. Am I? Well, you are, but not the type that I'm
early
thinking
on.
Of.
Okay. I do early on, and I like to use... Look, I think the worst thing that we can do, like we've gone through the last, 10 odd years of functional strength.
Right.
Right. So we're going to go to the gym and we're going to do get functionally strong for our sport.
Right.
And I'm thinking, well, hang on, why train the same pathways that we're training over and over again in our sport?
Right.
To make what? More of an imbalance? So why not fill the holes and the gaps and just get us strong in the areas that we need to? I'm a fan of full body stuff. I'm just not a fan of the hard thing is when we're having a look at a sport that is complicated when you've got to throw three disciplines in there.
I get it now.
And then we have time.
Yeah.
And time is not on our side for most people that work a full-time job and have families and other commitments. You're like, well, where do I fit it in? How many hours can I, you know, I'm majorly big on making sure we do our body maintenance stuff right. So if I can build that into a training session, because even that, if I go, okay, I want you to roll, do these specific rolling prior to this session and then finish with this, well, you know, that hour session now is an hour and a half or, you know, right. 80 minutes. So we have to build that in. And when we look at it, it's like if there's something that has to go, well, that part's going to go.
Right,
The specific in the gym strength session, because people don't have the time to go there, because we always have to look at that. Well, what's the time cost to get there, do it, get showered, get back to work or wherever they've got to go? So I am big on building what strength can we build in to the training sessions that we have and build that over time.
Right.
And then if there's anything that we need to do, some core stuff, whatever, well, let's build it into post-session after a run or after a swim and get it done.
Right
in that moment. So it's done, it's finished, and it's good.
Yeah, that makes sense to me now. I keep forgetting that you're trying to do three different sports at one, which just totally blows my mind, because I know how hard it can be to do just one sport. And you know, I mentioned Mike T. Nelson, he's been programming a strength system for me, and it was fine until I went to Colorado, and then I was away for a while and not answering emails as quickly as I once was. And then when I got back, the complexity of it just blew my mind. I just couldn't. Yeah. And I ended up doing nothing for a whole week just because I couldn't get any of it done. I just couldn't get my head around it. And I wanted to continue. He put together for me a really nice body weight program that I was doing whilst I was away in hotel rooms in Colorado. And that was fantastic. I was like, shit, Mike, can't I just keep doing the body weight thing? That was great. And in the end, he created a greatly simplified strength training program that I've just started this week. And it's, you know, three exercises per session. And it's fantastic. I love the simplicity of it.
I think that's what we've got to come back to, simplicity.
Yeah.
Right. Because we think there's these secret sessions or there's this or there's that. It's really just, it's following the process day in, day out. It's not getting, you know, get to the start line. Focus on getting to the start line, right. Not focusing on the finish line or the goal time or whatever, and do what's required. You know, these, you know it better than anyone. It's an endurance sport. It takes a certain amount of work to get to that goal result. And what I say when someone comes to me that's time poor and wants to, say, qualify for the Hawaiian Ironman or something like that, and I'm like, well, you know, you're at odds with your goals. But what we need to do is, this is not a 3-month thing. This is not a 6-month thing. This is the trials of miles. And you're going to need to just expand the time to goal completion. Right. So if you've got 8 hours or 9 hours a week and that's all you have, cool. Let's make the best 9-hour program that you can hit week in, week out. Yes, there's progressions. Yes, we'll swap things around with great feedback and communication. And let's roll that out for the long haul. You focus on the process, you'll get stronger, you'll get faster, you'll get fitter. And we'll keep doing that. And I guarantee over time, guess what? You don't need to do those massive weeks. You may throw a big week in here or there, but then you'll be able to get competitive, mm-hmm. but it's over the long haul. Where some people can, you know, very few may Ironman monk it, and they might get away with it one or two builds and then they're going to crash. Okay. It's just see it over and over and over again. So it's about building a plan that there's some time that we have to work hard in that race specific phase for sure. And you're going to get tired, but we need to build up to that so the body can handle it.
Right.
So we have that resiliency. So it's, you know, I like to go, it's a lesser program early on and we build as we go through.
Uh-huh. And do you have a way that you monitor the readiness status of your athletes? You get to talk to them or look at them or do you use something else?
Yeah, look, it's communication and feedback. I use Training Peaks as how I plan out the training sessions. I do not use Training Peaks' own methodology on their fatigue score and their all the little things that they like to plug in there, because that's their own coaching methodology and it's
right.
doesn't fit in with me. Because, you know, from their fatigue, how are they making that number based on just an hour or the duration or what the person's doing and their scores and whatever? And there's too many factors that go into that in my mind. So, you know, was the session, you know, the session may have mostly been aerobically easy. And then, you know, we have tiny little bits peppered in that are some major work. And that major work may be more muscularly focused than tolerance focused.
Right.
So that's going to be a completely different fatigue level.
Okay.
So I just make sure that I'm getting the feedback. You know, if an athlete goes quiet, usually a good red flag to get in touch and and make sure everything's going well. Or with data these days, everyone uploads their data. I have a look at the data. But what's more important to me than the data, I can use that to cross-reference. But it's how they're feeling, what their comments are, their post-session comments, because that's the most important thing. And that's when, you know, after coaching since 2006, you have a pretty good handle on, you know, I've heard of everyone's life situation and by this day and seen a lot of logs, and you kind of get a feel for, hey, this person needs a little bit more of a break, and this person, yep, they're tired, but they can still push through.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a learning, and it really depends on the athlete age, athlete goals, and their personality type, because I've got some pretty tough guys and girls, and sometimes you have to pull the reins.
Right.
Other time you got to, you know, you're nowhere near tired yet. You don't right. know what it is. You think you are, but you're not there yet. And some people need that lovingly push to be able to get out of their comfort zone.
I think I might be the latter these days, you know. Let's talk about diet, because I know that it's something that you're really interested in. And tell me about what you've learned since the 1127 about fueling an Ironman triathlon.
Holy shit, what haven't I learned?
Yeah, it's kind of a big can of worms there. You might have to break it down a little bit.
You know, it's really funny leading up to that race. This is where I think, you know, I'd get sick a lot and I got injured and I continually get injured. And I was, what is it in pounds? I got down to about 60 kilos. So that is
130 something, I think.
Say 132 pounds.
Yeah.
Yeah. Super lean, but I'd get sick and injured quite a lot. And I found for me over the years, you know, 143 pounds, so 65 kilos seems to be the sweet spot where I haven't lost power. I feel strong and resilient. But what took me away from the, you know, we can call it the standard American diet or standard, you know, Western world diet and standard triathlete or endurance athlete diet of just highly refined grains and carb, or, you know, 24/7, you need to smash this, you need to carbohydrate load. And funnily enough, my first half Ironman was when I went, this is wrong. This is completely wrong. This carbo loading shit is just bullshit. We had a coach at the time that also was the distributor of a sports supplement company called High Five out of the UK. So everyone in the group, obviously, because we got discounts, was on that stuff. And he had this carb loading protocol of this super carb drink that we'd drink one bottle, like 3 days out, two bottles, 2 days out, three bottles the day out. And I remember waking up before the race on race morning with my wife and just like, I had to eat a bar or two of these bars, and I opened it up and I'm like, if I even take a bite of that thing, I'm going to throw up. And I, to this day, that smell is with me, and I could not open one of those bars and not feel like I'm going to be sick. And I'm like, I'm just like shell shocked. I'm like, you can't go into a race feeling like this. It can't be good. Why go into a race? I feel lethargic. I feel heavy. I feel sick. This is not the way. So over time, we kind of just started refining, trying to clean up the diet. And it took a lot of years, and, you know, we still went down. And the reality was, really, my wife lost money on races with some showstoppers. And, you know, whether she was on the porta potties on the race on the marathon after doing really, really well or whatever else and getting continuous bloating. And we knew that she's had some level of gluten sensitivity. So we just played it. We played around with every diet there was under the sun and different ways of eating, from blood typing and all that stuff, and to just eating more real food. But it really didn't take until me getting diagnosed as a celiac that, you know, I was already on that fat adaptation kind of bandwagon.
Yeah.
And I was definitely more towards gluten-free eating, but it was like 80-20. All right. So I'd make my own really nice sourdough breads, but I'd also drink some really nice beer. And outside of that, have some pasta every now and then. But outside of that, it was predominantly gluten-free most of the time. So I'd say 80-20 or maybe even 90-10. And then there was a few factors. I had a freak accident where I perforated my esophagus, which put me into a pretty bad state in hospital for 7 days. And it was intravenous antibiotics, which I believe changed gut biome, which then led down to, you know, a whole lot of problems and things. And then I got 4 wisdom teeth out later that year and they got infected post-op and more antibiotics. And then I was training for Ironman again, and I think I got in my best ever state, better than the sub-9s that I'd been in. I was feeling phenomenal, and then, like, it was literally race morning. I had my normal pre-race dinner. I had a pizza with a beer. That was about it. And then, you know, woke up that morning, feel fine, and then, you know, it was pretty tough weather conditions, and they delayed the start, and they end up shortening the swim, and I got my wetsuit on, and about 5 minutes in, I felt like I had a boa constrictor around my chest, and I just got up onto the beach. When I came back in, I was like, I can't breathe. And I got onto the bike and there was nothing. Just couldn't breathe, couldn't do anything. And I went around for 90Ks and like, this is ridiculous. And it took a few months to find out that I was celiac after that. Yeah, and that kind of changed everything.
And did you get the actual diagnosis? So I feel like I've been here. I recognize this story exactly, but I never got the diagnosis because I figured out long before that I should stop eating bread. And really, most of the tests, they require you to still be eating the thing that's causing the problem, which nobody is doing anymore. So did you actually get the diagnosis?
What happened was I was then like still going through this process of what it is, because snowboarding days, I compression fractured T12. So I was going down that pathway because my back was hurting again, and I had this, I'm like, maybe I've done something to my back again and that's causing all that. And at this stage, I was training for a thing called St. Coles Challenge, which is 2,000 kilometers, 10 days in the Dolomites. And I was riding my bike and we were about 4 hours from home with a buddy of mine, and we'd stopped for a coffee and had a coffee, and I had a croissant with cream, and then the next 4 hours I was in horrendous pain, you know, chewing handlebars. I was just in just however I could get home, and my guts were in absolute pieces. I'm like, damn, I must have a problem with cream. And he was like, you know what, you should go and see my my godmother. She's a sports doc. She's down in Sydney. So I got an appointment with her and I flew down and had this whole thing. She's looking at all my scans and everything. She's going, you know what, I'm going to go left field here. I don't think there's anything musculoskeletal wrong with you. You've got something wrong with your gut. I'm like, wow, I haven't said anything about my gut, but you know what? I've been having some gut pains. And she's like, let's get you in for an endoscopy. So I flew back up to Queensland and booked in for an endoscopy, and then went to my GP and he opened it up and he's like, so you said you were 80-20 gluten-free. He goes, well, now you're 100%. It's like, you've come back with villiatropathy, which is consistent with celiac disease.
Right.
He says, look, you know, if you want to cross it off, the best thing is just stop eating it completely. And so for me, that was black and white.
Right.
There was no gray. I was like, yep, done. No problem.
Yeah.
But he said, look, get a gene test anyway. So both my wife and I got the gene test, and we both come back positive for celiac.
Right.
Even though hers that we don't think is actually switched on, but we both came back with that. So it was pretty easy. You know, we just went back home and threw out toasters, threw out all wooden chopping boards and utensils, and went shopping, and then went 100% gluten-free. And the hardest part was really the cross-contamination stuff.
Right, right. Yeah, I think the genetic test is necessary but not sufficient for the diagnosis, right? Lots of people have the HLA genotype but not necessarily have celiac. So I definitely have the genotype, but that's still not good enough for a diagnosis. So,
but I think if you have that, then you go, okay, well, it's, for me, that's a good enough reason not to eat.
Oh yeah, stuff. I totally would agree. So you've done much better then, obviously, once you made that change.
I did. And then I went backwards again.
Okay.
And then I spent many, many thousands of dollars in the US at a place in, I think it was Sunnyvale, California, with a functional medicine doctor and getting a lot of tests because I felt really good fairly quickly. And actually, I got through that Soncol's challenge and, you know, I rode strong. And funnily enough, going to Italy, you think that's going to be the worst place in the world for a celiac is actually fantastic. They are onto it. And
really? I've never been to Italy.
So they have, interesting enough, I think at kindergarten age, they test all kids for the genotype. And anyone that's diagnosed as celiac actually gets rebates from the government. I think they get a day off work or 2 days off work per month to go and source food. And all their pharmacies over there have a huge stock of gluten-free foods and they get rebates on them. It's amazing. And then every chef in the middle of nowhere in the Dolomites is like, oh, don't worry about that gluten-free pasta. I make my own. It's better. They're all onto it. You just say, io sono celiaco. And they're like, we, oui, no problemo. And you're fine. So, and it was great. Like, only I got cross contaminated once there because I really wanted a pizza and they had gluten free, but it still went into the same wood fired oven. So that next 220 to 20 kilometers that day after was pretty horrendous. But, but yeah, everything was going well. And then it started going bad again. And that kind of led me down to having adrenal fatigue and stuff like that. And it wasn't just the nutrition. It was a lot of stress and lifestyle stresses as well, which is always a big part of it. But what I did find out is that I have the MTHFR genotype as well.
Right, right.
I don't methylfolate. And then I also found out that eggs are a huge cross-reactor for me.
Okay.
But interestingly enough, over the years, I'd had some problem with eggs prior. And, you know, maybe reached a ceiling of tolerance and then took them out and brought them back in and was fine. But then, you know, they were causing me some problems. But funnily enough, these days, and what I had athlete's foot for years and years and years. And anytime I'd have something with an egg product in it these days, athlete's foot's come back. But as soon as I took eggs out, it cleared up. It's the only thing that did it. None of the ointments or anything like that. So it was really, really weird. It's like, oh, wow. So, and you know, unfortunately, you know, I loved eggs, but they're gone. So,
right.
But yeah, now I'm strong and resilient again. And I feel great, but it took some time. And, you know, I did do a number on my adrenals and it was a long process coming back from that. But there was a lot of work and business and other life stresses at that time.
Right.
In terms of, and training stresses that I put on the body. And obviously, being a celiac, that's a stress. So, those things added up. And then, you know, you take yourself out of the picture for a while. And it was a slow process building back up. There was a point where I had DOMS or delayed onset muscle soreness after walking around the block.
Yeah. Do you know what? That is a thing. Like, I've interviewed someone, a really competitive swimmer, that talked about this same thing. And I had it too, that, you know, somehow I was able to do 20 hours a week of cycling. Yet if I were to climb the stairs up to my office, like, my legs would be burning. Like, I mean, it's not lactic acid, is it? It's hydrogen ions. But you know that feeling, right? Like, you've just done some really intense exercise and all you've done is walk up the stairs. And like, this is not right. I'm supposed to be an athlete.
Yeah. I remember the first time it happened. We'd just run it. I'd organized a charity ride that rode from Bondi Beach in Australia up to Noosa in between Boxing Day and New Year's. And back in 2013. And I rode up, you know, strong the whole way. It was fine. We went through some horrendous environmental conditions and got through on New Year's Eve and was gold, it was, you know, 1600 kilometers or whatever it was. And then, so 1,000 miles. And it was, and literally, I think it was about 3 days later, I hopped on a flight to go to a marketing event in San Diego. And then I stayed at my buddy, who's one of the top Ironman professionals in the world, Luke McKenzie, and stayed at his place. We went for an easy 50-minute jog above Encinitas there, and I had muscle soreness for like 6 days.
Oh,
I was,
wow,
like, something is not right.
Yeah.
That's when I went up to San Fran and got all the testing.
Well, good for you. I'm glad you sorted it all out. Talk about your diet now then. So you're doing ultra running right now, which is obviously very steady state. How much carbohydrate do you eat?
I'm actually playing around because I have so many athletes that are vegan. And I went to Ghana.
Why is that? Can you explain why that is?
I don't know. Mostly girls.
Okay.
I don't really know. Most of them is an animal thing, to be honest.
Okay.
But, you know, I went to Ghana to do some water well projects with a friend in the end of November, start of December. And I just felt, coming back from that, you know what? I'm going to try this. I'm going to try being vegan. Now, this is going to be really hard as a fat-adapted athlete because naturally the carbohydrate amount increases. But I think I've done pretty well. So what's that? Start of December through to now, I got a 50K race this weekend. I wanted to test it through to there. And I feel strong, resilient. You know, I don't feel any different to how I was eating before. But honestly, my carbohydrate has increased
right.
because the beans and everything else. And I did find through my celiac journey and adrenal stuff, recovering from that, I always did better when I had a little bit of starch, whether it's sweet potato or some white rice every day.
Right.
If I had a little bit of that, I would be in much better condition.
Right,
if I didn't, I would feel horrendous. So, you know, that's an N equals one experiment right there, and just kind of getting to know your body. But typically prior to this, I still typically don't eat anything in the morning. I'll have my fat black coffee. I'll have a big glass of water with some Himalayan salt before, and maybe some lemon or maybe some apple cider vinegar. And then I'm out the door running. And I'm doing about 100 kilometer weeks at the moment. And that's about a ramp up for my first 100 miler coming up. And I'll come back and I just eat a lot of real food. So I eat a lot of vegetables that don't have a lot of carbs in them, so to speak, but right. nutrient density. And then, you know, I'll have some beans or whatever, or a little bit of rice or brown rice at this current stage. But I'm still fairly liberal with fat, whether, and now I'm, you know, I'd say I'm pushing the vegan pathway, but I'm still having butter in my coffee. And okay. I still put butter on some vegetables, and I don't want to be that anal. Like, yeah. I don't want to be somewhere and go, hey, but, and be a pain in the ass more than I already am. So it's like, you know what? I'm fine. You know, I'm not going to, if someone's put some mozzarella on that pizza, I'm not going to, it's not worth the extra stress in my mind. But I have so many questions. Is this a lifetime thing? I don't know. I have a whole bunch of questions that I need to get some other doctors and people, because, you know, we look at studies and people say it's science, but then we go and even the people, you know, going, hey, plant-based diet is everything and look at this study. Then you go deep into their studies. They're still biased. And that's a lot of my problem with science, is that it doesn't matter, because there's always, you know, you're going to be biased to the path that you're following. So I'm trying to be non-judgmental in one part, but also be non-biased while I'm going down this pathway. And, you know, I was listening to a podcast the other day, and they were saying that it's proven that meat is what's creating diabetes, not sugar. And I'm like, hang on.
That's actually not right.
Hang on. My bullshit meter's going up, and I'm like, hang on. No. Like, hang on. And this is kind of making me angry. I'm going, Christian, why are you getting angry here? I want to see the facts. And I go back and have a look at some of that stuff. And it's like, oh, there's a vegan scientist. But to me, it's like, yeah, maybe that is a case, and they can prove that. But where's the meat that these people are eating coming from? What
right.
is that fed? And let's look at I want to see the rest of their diet.
Right.
Because I guarantee they're not just eating meat.
Yeah. So I'm not clear then. Why are you doing it then? Is it just so that you can better problem solve for your athletes that you're coaching?
Pretty much. I love testing things. I love being in the trenches and seeing. And funnily enough, I still feel good. My cooking is – I love cooking, and so does my wife, but – you know, we've got so many more dishes now that it's like, oh, this is actually cool. I've got a great veggie burger that tastes phenomenal. And you're like, this is actually really tasty food.
Yeah.
And to be honest, if I'm sitting here right now going, what would I think would be the best diet? I think it would be a lot more plant-based than most people are eating.
Yeah.
And I don't think we need to eat meat protein every single meal, even every single day for that matter. But I think if we had a little bit of it, you know, I still believe that liver is just so nutrient dense and potent. As long as you're mindful about where you're getting this stuff from and
right.
where you're getting your meat from. But if sardines, they're pretty potent in everything that you get from them. I know that bone broth was hugely beneficial to my gut healing.
Right.
So there's some things there that, and I know how beneficial it is pre-massive racing too. Like before Ironman, like I cramp at the best of the times, and it's not from lack of conditioning. And I know that I've got to stay on top of magnesium, but if I had bone broth prior to a race or a big day, it didn't happen. It just didn't happen. It's like, I wouldn't have figured that out unless I played with it prior to training sessions. So, you know, now for me, a typical day is, you know, I train on nothing just because I've done that for years and years and years. I don't think it's right for everyone, maybe especially some females. I don't feel like I need to eat straight away, but sometimes it just happens. And it's usually some sort of cook up, or I make a big, you know, if I am really time poor, I'll make like what I call a breakfast bowl, and, you know, use some plant-based protein in a blend of, you know, with avocado and some cashew milk or something like that, and some greens and maybe half a banana or something, or some blueberries in there
right.
for a quick meal. Otherwise, it's typically always real food. And
yeah, I was going to say it's still a real food-based diet.
Everything is all day. You know, we eat a lot of veg. Yeah, my wife still eats meat. My son still eats meat. It's for me. It's just a testing pathway. I still cook bacon every morning. But this is the thing that I find mind blowing and interesting. When I made that decision and I gave that decision a time frame, I didn't feel like it. I don't feel like I'm missing out, to be honest. I'm not like, you know, I'm cooking bacon for my son, smelly, and I love the bacon. Huh. And you know, we're mindful of where our food comes from and where we purchase. But I was like, this is I find this fascinating that I'm not going to succumb to this and I feel okay. So, yeah, it's been an interesting journey so far. I just kind of want to see where that goes.
Yeah. Well, if I sign up for your as a coaching client and I start the McDonald's diet, so I eat all of my food from McDonald's, would you do the same to so you can help troubleshoot for me?
No, because I can troubleshoot that without having to do it.
That's funny.
That's a pretty easy one to troubleshoot. You know, I've become a bit more relaxed now. Like, I do push heavily on real food. I'm not going to push veganism on anyone. I'm not going to push, you know, even athletes that don't want to go down and, you know, a metabolically more efficient diet. Lower carb, higher fat, not low carb. I feel people go, the pendulum swings too far.
Right.
And, you know, if they don't want to, fine. I just try and provide the advice and the support that they need. And if things come up, I'm like, well, maybe you should try. Just try. You don't know. So that's probably a big reason for me. I can't really critique something unless I've tried it. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I worked at McDonald's for many years, so I can tell you the athlete diet doesn't work. Yeah, for me, it's just like, you know, ooh, I'm here. Is this going to benefit my health or not? Well, there's only one way to find out. I know it's not going to – eating more vegetables is not going to do a number on me. So and then we can do testing to see, all right? So –
right.
But yeah, I'm more like, hey, if there's one thing I want you to do as an athlete, I want you to eat more real food. I want you to get less reliant on all this refined crap and less reliant on, you know, so you don't need to take as many gels and stuff like that. So, you know, where we can get smarter on our race nutrition. But I do find at the moment people get into a situation where they feel like they're doing all their training and they don't need to eat that much and they're still performing real. And then they go and don't have anything on race day because they haven't trained their ability to actually take carbs strategically and use them. And because when you are metabolically efficient, those sugary carbs work really, really well in a race situation. But when we haven't actually trained it, you're not going to feel like taking those on.
Right. So, yeah, I'm glad that you touched on that topic, actually, because we talked about it offline. And I thought, blimey, I'm certainly guilty of that one. You know, I've been through a 7-day stage race and not eaten or really even drunk anything every single day on like 3-4+ hour stages. And the reason I didn't want to do that is because that's what I do in training, right? I don't eat anything while I'm on my bike. And I think that's a mistake. And I've recently started reintroducing the MCT oil powder that we made. And that does have some very small amount of carbohydrates available in it. And so that's a mistake that you see a lot of people make then.
Tons and tons. And I think you need to look, you know, we say don't try anything new on race day. And, you know, that's typically an age old cry there. But, you know, people, they're not training what they're going to do on race day in their big race specific phase.
Right.
So come race day, they're not going to try something new because they haven't been doing it.
Right.
But then it's going to impact performance.
Right, right.
Because if you want to, like, yes, Ironman's a long day, but you can still race pretty fast. You need to support that.
Right.
Stage racing, yeah, you're on and off and you got days and days and days to back
up. Yeah, so I had time to refeed at least in between days. Yeah.
But on a one day where it's essentially a time trial from start to finish,
right,
you're going to have to put some calories in. And it doesn't need to be a huge amount, but you definitely need some. And I even made that mistake in Ironman Canada last year. I was just a little bit low over that first 90 minutes and it hurt me at about the 3.5 hour mark into the race. And I know I definitely felt loss of performance there. So it's like, no, you need to go back to drip feeding more in. And funnily enough, your body has the ability to take it and you can always add more, like rather than just trying to smack in tons, what most typical athletes do. Well, then, you know, it's pretty hard to subtract,
right?
Or it's not fun to subtract. But, you know, if you drip feed stuff in, then it's good. And when you're metabolically efficient, you'll find you don't need as much. But what you do use is going to work really well.
Right. Yeah.
But it has to be trained.
I think that's really important and interesting. And one thing I've noticed, so I did a 5-hour ride recently where I did have nothing. And guess what? I was absolutely fine. Like I didn't notice any difference at all. And I feel like in the beginning, the fasted state training was really important for improving my metabolic flexibility. And now that I have that, I can still eat something on the bike and not lose that, right? I'm not going to go backwards just because I started doing what I was doing before. And
no.
It's interesting that the thing that's going to take you to the next level is not necessarily the thing that got you to the level where you're at now. It could be, you know, you want to like find the magic answer and, oh, I just keep doing this forever and I'm going to get great results all the time. And unfortunately, it just doesn't work like that.
Yeah, I think, again, we've got to come back down to that. Look, we're all made up of the same essential ingredients. I don't think there's many of us that are really unique, special snowflakes out there. Actually, I don't think anyone is. But there is, when it comes to fueling and stuff like that, is definitely an N equals one. Mm-hmm. And you need to, like, when people are like, well, how much sodium do I need per hour? And how many calories? And I'm like, I'm sorry, I wish I could give you the formula, but I can't. I can't tell you how much. I can give you a guideline. Like, you probably don't want to be pushing over this and you probably don't want to be going under that. Somewhere in there, you're going to find a sweet spot. And it could still be off, but you're going to have to test it and you're going to have to try it and figure out what works best for you. For me, it's like, and then it's, well, what kind of nutrition should I take? And I'm like, really? At the end of the day, what works for you?
Right.
And that's what you have to use. I'm more biased towards stuff that's not a chemical shitstorm when you look at the back of the packet. You know, less ingredients is better. But, you know, if it works for you, go for it.
Right.
And use it because, you know, we're using it few and far between. It's not like we're living on this stuff. And I know a lot of athletes that live on sports nutrition day in, day out, and that's not a good thing. But, you know, if we're just using it in a, you know, in our race specific phase on some of those harder sessions, well, that's fine. And then because you're training what you're going to do on racing, if you hardly ever take on fluids during your long bike ride, well, when you need to take them on with your salts and stuff, then it's not going to happen.
Right.
You just forget. It's a process, and you've got to train that process. And I think I went really fast as a carb dependent athlete, but I was still smart enough that I went, hey, there's not enough. I don't need that much. And if I just drip feed it in, it's going to work.
Right.
And ironically enough, I'd look at my biddens at the end of the day, end of the race, and when I picked my bike back up, and I hadn't consumed nowhere near as much as I'd planned for. Mm-hmm.
Tell people why they should listen to the Fat Black podcast.
Because it's awesome.
Because it's awesome. That's a great one-word answer. Can you give me a longer answer?
Yeah. Look, I have a whole bunch of different topics we speak about, whether it's from endurance performance. There's a lot on nutrition. There's a lot on, you know, the stuff that we share an interest in. We have a lot of interviews on other athletes, the mental game. It's a good eclectic mix of topics. And the base purpose and goal at the end of the day is to provide our listeners really with some great things that they can take onto their on board that will help improve their own life. And some of this stuff is not just about improving our performance, whatever the sport that we do, but that it then transfers positively into other areas of our life. And that's big for me as a coach as well, because if I go, hey, if we teach you these lessons through here, well, then you're going to be a better husband or wife or better at your job or more inspirational to someone else. Or you may help that person that you don't even know you're helping. And so that's a big one for me. It's like that purpose is really that it is much more than triathlon. It's much more than endurance sports. You know, it's just being about being better every day. And, you know, for us, endurance sports is just the vehicle.
I like it. Do you have any space for coaching clients at the moment?
We've always got space between myself and my wife. I'm never going to turn away and good systems and stuff like that. We do limit it to, I'm never going to go so far where I'm going to drop the ball on what we provide. But, you know, I never turn down someone that's going to be a good fit and to work with. So, and these days I don't even let dollars really get in the way of that. You know, I've done a lot of free coaching over the years, and unfortunately, typically the people aren't really invested.
Right.
They don't do the work. They don't have skin in the game. But, you know, since moving to Whistler, we have people that can afford my typical rate and we have people that can't, but they still want to do that. And they're great people. So I'm not going to let finances get in the way of looking after someone and helping someone get better at what they want to do. We do a good thing and we love it. I'm just passionate about getting people fit, fast, healthy, and kind of push through some barriers that they might not even know that are there. And most of that's between the two ears, really.
Wow. That's generous and admirable.
Thank you.
Well, tryspecific.com is the website. I'll link to that in the show notes. Is there anything else that you'd want people to know about?
No, that's about it. You can catch everything there. You can learn all about us there. The podcast is a great place to go, though. Oh, the other place, if you want to ask questions, we have a private, but it's open to anyone, Facebook group. It's called the Tri-Specific Cafe, which you can get to from trispecific.com/TS Cafe. It's about nearly 700 people in there, and they can ask all questions and different things on that. And, you know, they're not all our athletes. I have a specific athlete group as well, but those ones are just for anyone. Anyone that's interested, wants to continue conversations on the podcast or ask specific things or get some advice, we're there for you there.
Oh, wow. That's amazing. I'll check that out.
Awesome.
Cool. Well, thank you very much for your time, Christian. I really appreciate you.
Thank you, Chris. And thanks for this opportunity to be on your podcast, and looking forward to having you back on ours.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you.